Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it, or that I listen to just after I listen to it. The idea is that whenever I finish a book, I do the review here as a podcast and stick it up in the podcast feed. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, that's when it happens, which means that now it's a bit of a pity that I'm going to be reviewing today's book after a period of maybe about a week since I finished reading it or listening to it. I don't really have any other news apart from that, so I'll just get straight into it. The book that I'm going to be reviewing today is called The Unincorporated Man by a brother team of Danny Colin and Eitan Colin. It was published last year, 2009, and it turns out, I looked it up on goodreads.com, and it turns out it's about 480 pages long. I think it worked out as an audiobook at around about 25 hours, which means it's actually really long. It's a very long book to get through. And also, through absolutely no planning and 100% coincidence, two books in a row written by brother teams last episode. It was A Roadside Picnic by Boris and Arkady Strugetsky, and now it's Danny and Eitan Colin with The Unincorporated Man. A little bit about the audio production. I thought it was pretty good. I can't remember the narrator's name, but I really have no complaints at all about the narration with the material that he's given to work with. You know, he could do all the voices and all the different things like that, and I was quite impressed by that. So, I mean, I don't really have anything else to say about the audiobookness of it, so I'll get really straight onto it. The reason I read this book mainly is because it was recommended by a few listeners, and also I heard some good buzz about the book from in real life as well, from people who I know. They said, oh yeah, I heard this is a good book. Strangely enough, I never actually spoke to anyone who had actually read it before, but I did get a pretty good vibe about it. So I'll get straight onto it. The world of the book is a real strength of this, because the book really doesn't seem to me too much about the people or the plot, or it is, but you know, that's not the strongest element. The strongest element about this is really the world that is set in. A little bit about the technology, which I'll talk about later, but mostly around about the political and economic kind of setup of the world of 300 years in the future. It is actually set 300 years in the future, and it seemed to be very specifically non-specific about the date that it was set. For example, it was saying, okay, he was asleep. I'll talk about it a bit more, but so he was asleep for 300 years, and he woke up, and 300 years ago this, 300 years ago that, and it was always 300 years ago, but it never says specific dates, which is good in a way. It's trying to set it so it doesn't immediately go out of date. So 300 years in the future, lots of things have happened in that time. Sometime in the 21st century, there's what's called the Grand Collapse, and that's a massive economic disaster, and the population of the Earth reduced down to about a quarter, or just a few billion people, and then slowly built back up. But the rebuilding was done sort of based of this political group, which comes from, first of all, from Alaska, and then from Alaska spreading out. And they have this very, very libertarian kind of view of the world. And what took place, the most important thing, of course, is the incorporation movement. And the idea with this is that everyone, when they are born, they issue 100,000 shares, or 10,000 shares, or so many, just say 100% of shares, and they theoretically own all of it themselves, but immediately upon being born, 5% of it goes to the government, and 20% of it goes to the parents of whoever is born. And then what happens, they go through life, and if they need anything, they have to sell shares in themselves. So if they need an education, they sell shares. If they want to get different training or different benefits, they sell shares in themselves to other people and to other corporations. And in doing so, the corporations and parents and government and other people have interest in them. So they, if they earn any money, they have to, you know, whatever percentage that they or whatever they earn, 5% of it goes to the government to sort of run courts and, you know, terraforming Venus and all these other government projects that are there. 20% goes to the parents, and then the rest of it goes to the other people. So some people only own a few percent of themselves. You can't, in the way it's set up in the book, is that you can't own less than 75% of you. So you can either own 75% of you or 25% of you or anything in between. And what happens is that the people who work for these big corporations, the corporations take, you know, 75% of the benefit, or, you know, 50% or 30% of the benefit or the work that the labor or any productivity or any money that they earn or any goods that they get all goes to these lots of different people. And the idea is that you work through life to gain a majority on yourself, so then you have more say about your own life than everybody else put together. For example, when you're growing up, your parents are the single most influential people, not just because they're your parents, but because also they own a large part of you in trust or the 20% of you as well. I thought this was a really, really great idea. The weird thing is that as you're reading it, you start thinking, oh, this is actually a really good idea that it could work, not just because, oh, this is an interesting world to set a science fiction novel in, that you start reading it, oh, no, this is actually a good idea. This would work, you know, as long as it's voluntary and nobody is forced into it. I would sell shares in myself. Say, you know, however much money I earn as a juggler, and I'm saying, okay, in the future, I will put, you know, all my future earnings, you can get 20% of all my future earnings if you buy this amount of stock in me now because I need to invest and do this. It does make sense to be able to do that. You're sort of like offsetting your own thing. It's sort of like a way of getting loans and money and investment on your own self. So instead of having to get a mortgage based on a house, which is a bit of property, you get it based on yourself. And of course, I would talk more about this idea, but this is really what the book is about. So if you're interested in this idea, you should really read the book, because it goes through lots and lots of different cases, lots and lots of different things. Now, there are one or two things that I pick out and go, oh, wait a second, what about this? Oh, wait a second, what about that? But I guess probably Danny and Aten Colin will probably go, oh, yeah, that's it. But, you know, we didn't want to put every single little case, every single little bit into this book that we didn't have to. But they do put a lot of this into the book. A huge part of the book, probably around about, I'd say about 40% of the book, is talking about the incorporation and about the world that it is set in, and the different people doing this, and there's court cases between different people to work out ownership and this and that, and if you can incorporate it, if you don't, and talking about, you know, for example, they talk about exploitation in the world. It's like, oh, well, if you own some child in Africa, it means you're exploiting them. And it's like, well, you're not really exploiting them, because if you do harm to them, it means that your future benefits back from that person will be reduced. And also, if they're harmed in any way, their stock goes down. So you've bought at a price, and it's your it's in your interest to keep that person's stock high, so you treat them well and stuff. And it's like, yeah, okay, that's great. So nobody's exploited. One thing that is a bit weird, though, is that you think, okay, this could really only work in like a needless kind of society where there's no poverty or anything like that. And because the level of technology is so high, it's not really it's handy that everyone is fed and looked after and stuff like that, and they can rely on nanotechnology factories and stuff like that to sort out sort of general wealth and things. But really, there is a lot of good stuff concerned about this in there as well. Also, as well with the world, is that it's actually quite an interesting future, you know, utopian, dystopian kind of thing going on there. But also, just it's interesting technology in the future. It talks about, like, how not many people live in the country, and everyone goes and lives in New York and around the coast of America. There's lots of, you know, flying cars and tall buildings and, you know, space travel and all that kind of stuff. And that's also really quite interesting. Again, some little logical flaws in some of the bits and pieces, but generally very, very well realized, very well put together, well explained as well, like that. One bad thing about the future history, there's this thing called the Grand Collapse, and that's when, of course, this whole thing takes place. And there is a reason why the Grand Collapse takes place, and it's to do with virtual reality. So they have in place these virtual reality edicts, which is where you're not allowed to do any kind of virtual reality kind of stuff at all. You have to live in this reality. And it's quite well explained, but I didn't really buy it in a way. And then I was like, well, if that was the cause of the Grand Collapse, the economic situation that was put in place afterwards with his personal incorporation, while extreme, probably wasn't really needed. All you need to do is put in place the VR edicts, and then you say, oh, well, it wasn't just the VR, it was, you know, there's a nuclear war as well going on. It's like, okay, so to sort out the nuclear war, you don't really need the personal incorporation. Oh, but there was another thing as well going on, and there was lots of stuff that seemed to happen during the grand collapse, and it sort of put in place that this, you know, this personal incorporation movement was the thing that sorted it all out, whereas I'm thinking it's a little bit too much of a you know, a wrapped up perfect solution. I can't really explain exactly my disagreement with this, or my unsatisfaction with this, but it was just that one of those little niggly things about it. So, getting on to the plot here, it's about someone sleeping for 300 years. It is this sort of classical Stranger in a Strange Land kind of sleeper awakes kind of thing, where someone goes to sleep. Justin Cord, he's like this billionaire who is a billionaire. He earned all his money through some kind of industrial activity. He was some kind of inventor or something. It's sort of murkily defined. It's not a lot going on there. Anyway, he got cancer and his wife died as well. And he's like, okay, I need to freeze myself and hide myself away in this old mine over here. And his right-hand man, who is called Sebastian. It's not really much of a spoiler to say that, a tiny little spoiler, but as soon as the name Sebastian is mentioned by Justin Cord, as soon as you mention that, you work out what's going on there. Anyway, so Sebastian is the person who helps him get in there as well. And so he sleeps for 300 years, and then this mining prospector finds this old mine, and Justin Cord wakes up. And he's very, very rich again, because he's hidden away lots of different wealth. And also he's a very interesting person. So everyone, suddenly like the whole kind of media kind of frenzy goes on. He's a massive celebrity. And in this day and age, it's quite quite an interesting line in the book where you say the gossip pages is the front page, and the business news is the front page, because whenever any single person does anything, their stock goes up or down. So everything is business. Even gossip papers are big business, or they have to be business, because when you find out about someone, or if someone's doing something interesting or not interesting, or they've cheated on someone or they've not cheated on someone, all these different kind of things, it's all about stock, and people are made on rumors and gossip and things like that. So of course Justin is a big sort of celebrity. Again, at the beginning, you're not quite sure who he is, and he's a bit secret, but very, very quickly, which is a bit of a disappointment. I'd rather him stayed secret longer, but quite quickly within the book, pretty much within the first quarter of the book, he becomes very, very famous of being someone who's woken up in the future. And what happens is, of course, not only is he very rich and very, very popular and very lots of people are interested in him, he's also unincorporated. And of course, he is the unincorporated man of the title of the book. And there's this big battle between him and GCI, which is the big sort of Omnicorp corporation kind of thing, like the big monolithic corporation which is running the solar system. There's others going on as well, but they're running their stuff, running most stuff. They want him to incorporate him, because they woke him up. They are like, oh yeah, and we should own a bit of him because of all this and that and stuff like that. So the main sort of like antagonist here, the main actor going against Justin Cord, is a guy called Hector Sambianco, and he works for GCI Corp, and he wants Justin to incorporate, you know, loads of different reasons, but he becomes sort of like the evil nemesis to Justin Cord. There's one other main character, which I guess is Neela. She is Justin Cord's reanimationist. Now, what happens is that lots of people have over the years frozen themselves, gone into cold sleep, but it's not something that anyone has done for as long as Justin. So most people have been to sleep, have started their suspended animation session during the era of personal incorporation, and then they wake up again and they sort of come back to a world which they pretty much know. You know, society has moved on a little bit in some ways, but generally they come back. And Neela is a reanimationist, and a reanimationist is meant to help people, you know, readapt to society, whatever stuff they go on. If they've, you know, people have died, that they know people who have died, and, you know, the reanimationist is there to sort of help break the news. I think that that's what's going on, because the problem is with Neela, this main character, being a reanimationist, we never see her working in her real job. We never actually see her doing her normal day-to-day job when she's reanimating people who've only been asleep for 6 months, or helping reanimate people who've only been asleep for 10 years. But then, you know, we jump straight in and we see her doing her job with this like really kind of out of left field case of someone who's been in cold sleep for about 300 years. So it seems like she's just there to make Justin feel good, or but again, I'm not really entirely sure. She's there to answer lots of questions as well. And also she's there as the main love interest to Justin Cord. There are other characters, you know, there's lawyers that are employed, you know, by Justin, and there's the other people on the GCI Corporation, and there's lots of stuff going on there as well. And that's it, really. But it's mostly those three characters who drive the plot. Except, and this is the big problem with the novel, while the world is very well realised and there's lots of stuff going on, there isn't actually that much in the way of plot. One subplot, which is the main plot, is that Hector Sambianco is trying to get Justin Cord to incorporate, and Justin Cord doesn't want to because he sees incorporation as some kind of partial slavery, that he's being owned, and he doesn't want to be owned even slightly, even though the system is obviously working and everything's going okay, or is it? You know, that's a bit strange as well. And Hector is trying to get him to incorporate, but there is this love plot which was actually quite interesting for a while, but then suddenly not interesting, because the idea is that a reanimationist and reanimationee is that relationship is taboo. You can't get physically involved or emotionally involved in that way. It's sort of like a doctor-patient kind of relationship, teacher-child kind of relationship. Too much power by one person. Although it's never really explained what has gone wrong in the past, it's just explained that this is taboo. So you're always like, okay, Justin and Neela, they can't be together, but then they want to be together because, of course, Justin is perfect because he is obviously Danny Colin, or one of them anyway, and Neela is perfect because she is the love interest, and she is perfect, like, even though we're just told she is, and we're told she's great, and we're told she's beautiful, and she is quite interesting in some ways, but a little bit sort of, you know, puppy eyed about Justin. Justin's a bit like, hey Neela, woo. So that's a bit weird, but of course it's forbidden love, but of course they do get together, but it doesn't happen near the end of the book. It happens around about halfway through the book, and all this taboo relationship is always really taboo, always taboo, and everyone's got, oh, you can't do this, oh, you can't do this, and there's the other reanimationist who's like the reanimationist specialist called Dr. Gillette, and he's like, oh no, you can't do this, and everyone else is like, oh no, you can't do it. And I thought, okay, they're definitely going to do it, and then the second half of the book of this sort of like love interest story is going to be the massive fallout and Justin being shunned by everyone and Neela having to go into hiding and all that. But it doesn't happen. It's sort of like they get together at the Mardi Gras, sort of given that way, but it's quite obvious that's going to happen. And then suddenly it just gets dropped. That whole part of the story is just like, okay, and they're together, and everyone's okay about it. And I'm like, wait a second, this was a massive boundary. This was a massive barrier that they had to get over. And then it was there. All these other little subplots and stuff that goes on as well is that there's court battles. And this is another thing which is a bit annoying. There's two major court battles, and that's sort of about 1.5 major court battles too long. Now, I really did enjoy the ideas behind the court battles, and I really did enjoy the politics behind them and the maneuvering in the board of the GCI Corporation or the CGI Corporation or whatever it was, with Hector and the chairman and the head of legal and the head of advertising and stuff like that. That was actually quite interesting, except what was happening in court wasn't that interesting, because the way that the people won the court cases wasn't like, you know, okay, here's one set of logic and here's another set of logic, and them going against each other, because we knew that one person was doing the right thing, which was Justin, and one person was doing the wrong thing, which was Hector Sembianco. But the only way that they could get out of it was by some arcane knowledge by, you know, Manny, the lawyer who came in, and suddenly he goes, ah, ha, ha, but look at this bit of the text. And he's like, oh, yeah, look at that bit of the Constitution. I hadn't read the Constitution properly, and it was a bit sort of, like, weird. In the second court battle, I was like, yeah, but why don't they just, you know, if it's just going to be sort of like, oh, yeah, but look, there's this rule over here that we didn't tell you about until now. And I was like, yeah, and the rule that they did use there, I thought of a better explanation, which was, I thought was better, but then that wasn't used. Anyway, three main problems with this story here, even though I had some small stories. Like Damon, the book that I read the other day, the main character isn't really fighting for anything. In Damon, the main character was pretty much the demon, the weird billionaire games designer, and he was the bad guy, but he was the one driving the action. It was the bad demon driving the action all the way through, and the good guys are just sort of reacting to it and trying to keep things how they were. Now, this can work okay, but within a story, you really need the good guys, the protagonists, to want something, and people are trying to stop them wanting something, or if it's like a disaster movie, It has to be more than just, oh, there's a disaster, but I don't want there to be a disaster. Or, oh, there's this big thing happening, but I don't want that to happen. It must be, oh, there's this big thing happening, but and that's keeping me away from this, and I need to go and fight for that. You know, it's sort of like basic kind of storytelling. And in here, Justin doesn't really do anything. His backstory is more interesting, with him freezing himself, coming out, and sort of like within the first sort of like the first 5 or 6 hours of this book was a good story, and I was at the end of it, I was like, oh, this is good. And then from then on, everything is Hector. Hector Sambianco is trying to get Jason to incorporate, and then Hector fails, and then Justin, you know, then he does something else, and then he does it, and then Justin defeats him again. And at every turn, Justin easily defeats Hector. And again, basic story workshop here. Let's just go over it. Your protagonist must be defeated a number of times before triumphing in the end. It's classic storytelling. You've got to set it up. He's got to go against it, sort of like the antagonistic force, and then he's got to fail a few times, and then in the end he beats it through and wins, and we share in his triumph. But here what we have is a cycle of Justin and his team winning, and then they go up against and win again, and then they win again, and then they win again. To raise the stakes, they just make them win bigger and bigger battles, which isn't interesting. What you want them to do is lose a series of battles and then win a big battle in the end when it really counts. But during the book, they just go, okay, we're going to up the stakes and we're just going to kill millions of people. And you're like, okay, why do you just kill all these millions of people? Say, oh, it's really important what Justin's fighting for, and to prove it, we're going to kill millions of people. It's like, yeah, but it's too easy for him. So here's a better plot for this book. So what they need to do is rewrite the book. Justin wakes and he's unincorporated. Everything up until, like, the waking part is good in this book. Yeah, okay. And the explanation of the whole system. The system is really interesting as well. So what you need to do, he wakes up and he's unincorporated. And then, like, straight away, or, like, very soon into the book, he needs to lose all of his worth. And he's tricked into, you know, tricked by Hector into incorporating himself. And because he doesn't have any parents, Hector becomes his legal guardian. And, you know, the government gets 5%. But then, you know, the GCI Corporation and Hector managed to get, like, 75% of him. And then he's, you know, there's court cases, and he loses some of the court cases, and then he's ordered to go and work on the moon. And while he's really popular and people like him, you know, he's sort of shunned, and he's not really that worth a lot of much, or maybe nobody knows about him much. And then he goes to the moon, and there he meets Manny, the amazing lawyer, who's willing to fight for him. And, you know, then he gets a publicist, and they do it that way, and then they use the system for him to win back his majority. And then maybe in the end, you know, Hector defeats him one more time, and then Sebastian, Justin's old right-hand man back when he was in the 21st century, you know, who's this main character, who you think is going to be a main character, he's actually the guy secretly running the world. And because Sebastian is secretly running the world with Justin's old billionaire wealth from back in the 21st century, actually, Justin turns out that he owns a majority share in Sebastian, who's secretly running the world. And then suddenly we realize that Justin now can order around Sebastian, who is actually Hector's boss. And this kind of storyline, there's loads of potential here for a really interesting storyline in this whole thing. And then by, of course, the end of it, it turns out that Justin, through owning somebody else, actually owns his own himself, you know, in this cyclical, I own your stock, you own my stock, and my stock is worth nothing and yours is worth everything, but I own all of you, you know, that kind of stuff. It would have been really interesting to do that. And while the world is set up in really is in a really good thing, a good way, the plot just doesn't go anywhere. Second big problem with the plot, there's no set, even if the plot is obvious and it doesn't really go anywhere, there has to be some kind of sense of mystery. Like I say, after 5 hours, 6 hours of this audiobook, all of the stuff that needed to be explained so far was explained, and then what was happening was just like this cycle of Hector coming in and going, aha, wait a moment here, and Justin going, no, 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 no. And then it was like, aha, wait a moment here, and then Justin going, no, 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 no. And again, I've mentioned it before, stuff happening does not equal plot. It just means more stuff is happening. Because it got to the point where I was just reading to find out what happens next. Now, sometimes, if there's interesting stuff happening next, I don't mind reading to find out what happens next. But what I really enjoy reading about in fiction is reading to find out what happened earlier. So there's some mystery in there, and I want to find out the secrets behind the events, or the motivations of other characters, or what happened, or what the person's real identity is, or, you know, there has to be some mystery throughout. Now, in this novel, there is a single mystery, but the answer to the mystery wasn't actually... Well, there was a really obvious answer to the mystery that I had in my head, and the single mystery that there was in the book, at the end of the book, wasn't as interesting as the obvious answer. And if you're not going to use the obvious answer, you've got to use a non-obvious answer which is more interesting than the obvious answer. You can't be non-obvious and boring. You've got to be non-obvious and interesting, or just be obvious. I don't mind obvious as long as it's, you know, the obvious thing can be interesting in its own right. So that was another problem. Stuff happens, but and absolutely no mystery. And there's a really good reason for this, which I'll get to in the writing part. Third big problem, what is called fuck yeah moments, which was I saw a link to a blog on the io9 website, science fiction web. I don't normally read it because it's not always very much about books, it's more about TV shows and movies and comic books and stuff like that, but it was talking about fuck yeah moments, and there's different kinds of them. Just search for fuck yeah moments io9 and you'll be able to find it. And it's the idea that when something happens in a book or a TV show or a film or a movie or a comic book or any other kind of media that you want, someone has to do something heroic and it makes you go fuck yeah. And and it talks about, you know, Batman does fuck yeah moments, and you know, and other people do this, and in TV shows you have fuck yeah moments, and this is the air, you know, and it makes you go yeah, fuck yeah. Now Damon, the book that I really didn't like the other day, was pretty much like, I say, it was like a Michael Bay film, and Michael Bay pretty much goes for a series of fuck yeah moments. It's that's what he does, you know, you see something and you go fuck yeah, you know, and it doesn't really matter about the plot or the character, you just want to see someone do something interesting, go up against the odds, throw themselves into the abyss, whatever it goes up. And now that's what Demon was. It was just one after the other. Some of them worked, some of them didn't, but it did mean that the action sequences, while just dumb and stupid, were at least stuff happening, people doing interesting stuff. In this novel, there's not a single fuck yeah moment. Or maybe there's like one, half of one or something like that. But generally, nothing at all. No character ever does anything which makes you go fuck yeah, except that, you know, when Justin and Neela finally get together, you're like fuck yeah, get on with it, you know, just because you're always like all up until that time you're just like get on with it, and when they actually do you're just like fuck yeah, get on, which actually was pretty interesting sex scene in a way, pretty hot. Anyway, but in this novel there's no fuck yeah moments, certainly not by Justin, the main character, maybe by Hector in some ways, but otherwise not at all. And I guess I didn't write this down in my notes, but fourth problem, the ending was stupid and rushed. And the person we find out who's really controlling things, for someone who has got so much power and is so interesting, I'm trying to be a bit vague here, surprisingly stupid in the sort of, in the way that it finishes. And you're like, okay, it was a bit rushed, and what did Justin really do at the end? It's all a bit weird, and it really felt like, for such a long novel, and the ending felt rushed, yet at the same time, the ending wasn't rushed. Yeah, so the plot's all over the place, but like I say, the world that it's written in, and the things that you discover throughout the plot about the political system and about the history of the world and all that kind of stuff makes it interesting. And like I say, I was sort of interested in what happened next, but mostly I was reading to find out more about like the libertarian, extreme libertarian ideas of the authors, or one of the authors, or both of the authors, or whatever's going on there. But otherwise, the character's a bit plain and dull. I talked a bit about that. And also, in the end, I was just like, Justin wouldn't incorporate. And I was just like, incorporate? There's no reason not to. Everyone else, isn't it? It's great. And there's no problem. Why don't you just incorporate? And there's all these people, and it's like, no, I will not. No, I will not. No. And there was never seemed to be any doubt in his mind. It's like his driving force was non-incorporation, but he was unincorporated. So it's like his main driving force was to stay as he was, which meant Justin, exactly the same character at the end of the novel as he was at the beginning. Neela, exactly the same character as she was at the end. And Hector, again, exactly the same character at the end as he was. And there are a few characters who change slightly, but again, they're just sort of players. They're just parts. They're just things, they're just objects which are moved around and suitably interesting in their stories but not really in their characters, which is really strange that you can have someone with an interesting story but not an interesting character, or an interesting situation and not an interesting character. Moving on to the science and technology, there's a lot of really, really good fun science technology stuff in here. You've got, like, straight away you find out about something like sourceless light, which is like this spray on light. So the light doesn't come from anywhere, but it sort of emanates, and it's a bit weird. It's sort of like, not quite sure how it works, but it's an interesting idea. And you get like the flying cars and the really tall buildings and like the whole nanotechnology and like the moving houses with flowing rooms and stuff. And you find out that a lot of the technology in the world is, a slight complaint is that you discover it all right away. Justin wakes up and he's a billionaire, so he's immediately got access to all of the best care, all of the best technology. If he wants to do something, oh, he just flies. Do you want to fly to Venice? Yeah, I'll fly to Venice. Oh no, you can't, Venice is flooded, which is quite a cool line in the book. It's like, do you want to fly to Florence? It's like, yeah, let's fly to Florence. And they just do, they just go there and they get there in an hour, because they have like these suborbital flyers which are powered by laser from orbit, which is an interesting kind of thing. And you know, New York is big and is, you know, like I say, flying cars, a bit like, you know, kind of Fifth Element kind of stuff. So yeah, but there's like medical tension. But it is interesting to read about it. One thing that was a bit strange was the sort of like arbitrary rules that were put in place. For example, in Mardi Gras is like this yearly week long celebration, and lots of people like do body modifications and they mold their body into different ways. Like for example, the one guy is like, "What do you think about large phalluses?" And he just gets himself a 9-foot cock, and other people dress up in this way and dress up in that way. But lots of body modifications. But then the rest of the time, it seems like they're not allowed to do that, or nobody really has modified bodies, which is a bit strange. And I'm thinking, well, it's obviously, you know, you've got your nanotechnology, you can obviously modify your body in any way that you want, so why don't you? But then they just don't. Another strange thing, about halfway through the book, we get this big, long diversion, sort of like, you know, 2 or 3 hours or something of them going away, 2 hours of them in audiobook form, so probably what, like 100 pages or so, of people going away, maybe not 100 pages, maybe 50 pages, them going away and discovering, going into this sort of like virtual reality anti-indoctrination center. And the idea is that virtual reality is really, really bad, and it's explained in long detail that virtual reality is really, really bad. It's one of the main causes for the grand collapse. And to be honest, I didn't really buy it. First of all, everyone has to go and, you know, discover why virtual reality is bad. And to me, it actually sounded pretty good. You know, it sounded actually quite interesting, except that it wasn't done in moderation. And it's like, oh, television, someone has died because they stayed in front of television and didn't get up to eat. And someone has done the same with video games, and someone has done the same with the internet, and someone has done the same with eating, and someone has done the same with driving. You know, there's also lots of things that are bad for you if not moderated, if you don't moderate yourself. And it seems like that was the only reason against virtual reality, is that just, you know, poor impulse control by people in the late 21st century. But then, while that I didn't really quite buy, I mean, it was an interesting little diversion, but, you know, it could have just been cut out the novel completely. But the way that they indoctrinate people against virtual reality and really drive the VR edicts into them that, you know, the only reality that you should be experiencing is this reality, the way that it works is that you go into a center and you have a virtual reality trip, which turns out to be so horrific, and you find out what it was like for all the people who went through this horrific virtual reality kind of setup, that you don't ever want to do it yourself and don't think it should be allowed. Which, to be honest, was actually started off quite interesting, but was actually quite horrific. It was actually quite a well thought out idea. However, people are meant to do this in the novel, in the future world in the novel, people do this when they're really young, when they're like 8 years old or 9 years old. But what Justin went through when he went through it, if you'd stick a child through it, the child wouldn't be able to relate to the experience that Justin went through. And to be honest, I can't think someone who's only 8 year old would be able to relate to virtual reality and the evils of it and just all the ramifications of it at that young age. It would seem like you'd have to wait until they're at least sort of maybe 15 or 16, slightly more adult, slightly more mature, before they sort of grasp the overall badness of it. And that's in the first place, so I don't think it would work, you know. But second, if it did work on children, what you're really doing is pure child abuse. Now, I was talking to Jesse from the SFF Audio. He reviewed it on his site, and I mentioned this, and he said, yeah, but what about Holocaust museums? When do you, what age is the right age to take children along to a Holocaust museum? And I'm like, okay, that's great, but they're not experiencing the Holocaust. They're seeing pictures and stuff. And also, in the book, someone is left, like Justin, is left in a chair until he shits himself. You know, it's like really unpleasant. He's left in there, he doesn't drink, he wakes up completely. So if you do that to an 8-year-old child, it's pure child abuse, like pure child abuse. So anyway, so that was a bit strange. And also there's another science fiction element put in there, which I don't want to give away because I'm thinking, well, I could give it away, but it's inconsequential because it's this whole section which is introduced in the, like, after the, you know, within the, like, the last third of the novel, this whole sort of other kind of power structure and this whole other thing is set up in place, and you're like, wow, that's interesting, and you get a few scenes with them, but they don't have any impact into the rest of the novel, and they don't do anything. I'm thinking, okay, once I got to the end of the novel, I was realizing, okay, they're setting up for a sequel here, and this is for the sequel. But they didn't. It didn't have any impact onto it, except for maybe some little bits and pieces, but really wasn't very satisfying there either. But interesting, but just not really right. So, that, I guess, it brings me on to some of the writing of it. There's some really great lines in this novel. There's this great one about, you know, oh, something like this. Oh, it's like death and taxes are going to come back. Because I forgot to mention it, that it, pretty much everyone is immortal because, you know, medical advances have gone on so well, you know, that you can die, but it's, you know, only in an accident or something like that. And, of course, there's no taxes. So there's a great line about death and taxes, which is good. And there's lots of other good lines and little passages and small bits of conversation. There's some things that really stand out. However, it's very much sort of first novel writing, I guess. And one of the main things which really upset me, or which I found very strange, is that there's lots of switching between the points of views of different characters within the same things, within the same passage, within the same, not within the same paragraph, but within a few paragraphs you can get this person's point of view and then that person's point of view and then this person's point of view, which is a bit jarring. And also it doesn't help, you know how I said there was no mystery in the book? Yeah, this is one of the main problems, because we always know what all of the different characters are thinking, and while there's sometimes like, oh, what's that character over there thinking, suddenly the next chapter will be with that character, and then their motivations would be explained and everything that they know up until that point would be explained. The dialogue is a little bit clunky. It's a little bit like, oh, you know, as you know, Justin, it's like, okay, Neela, what are you talking about this? Well, Justin, it's about this and this and this. Ah, but what about this? Oh, well, it's this and this and this. Again, it doesn't really matter, because a lot of that stuff is the more interesting stuff. It's the conversations about the incorporation movement and all these other stuff, which is interesting. So I don't mind it, but again, it's not really realistic dialogue. Now, another great thing about this is the passive voice. Quick thing about passive voice is that when things happen to objects rather than people acting on things, you know, on the objects, you know, so for example, you know, stuff happens, movement happens. Actually, that's not a line from this book, that's a line from Crystal Rain by Tobias S. Buckell, which he wrote that with a like the most impressive passive voice. Although if he'd have said that, he'd have said something like, when Crystal Rain was read, the passive voice of Tobias Buckell was noticed and was found to be very impressive. You know, that's the whole thing. It's sort of like objects, things happen to objects. And I was reading this, and it's so many times there'd be a crowd scene and it was be like cheering happened, or, you know, there were cheers. And it's like, instead of saying the crowd cheered, it's like there were cheers. And it's just that time and time again. So I'm actually just now wondering, should I pass over the crown of the SFBRP crown of passive voice writing? Or let me put it this way. Yes, I'm wondering. Oh, I can't do it. I'm trying to speak in complete passive voice and stuff. Yeah, but I think actually Crystal Rain is going to keep the passive voice award just for the line "movement happened" or the phrase "movement happened." And I'm like, what movement? What moved? And what kind of movement happened? You know, so passive, so vague that you can't do. Another final thing, except for the pacing, like I said before, the end sequence is all rushed, and you know, when you get to the end of a book, and you're sort of like in a sort of like the epilogue thing, you can't really start going, okay, this is the end sequence, we really want to wrap it up, it's the final bit of action, or the final, and then they go, oh, and now let's have a large description of this large asteroid base, and talking about this, and it was spun up like this, and then they did this, and then they did this, and then you need to build it, and this is where the weight is, and this is where it isn't weightless. And I'm like, okay, not bad description, actually quite good science fiction, wrong place in the book. Really, we should be pushing to the end. This is the point, you know, all of that kind of technical description should really be like first half of the book, you know, and save the action for the second half and things like that. And also it's just way too long as well. This book is way, way too long. Another thing, like I said, just want to finish up here. The voice of the book is a bit weird. It's very much like, aha, this is an action part, and then we have action, action, action. Oh, and this is the libertarian exposition, philosophical economics part. Talk, 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 explain, 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 explain. Oh, and this is now the sci-fi part. Ah, sci-fi, sci-fi, action, sci-fi, action. Ah, and now this is the more explaining part and stuff like that. Very, very split into two, which I'm thinking one of the brothers is actually wanted to write a novel, and the other one was like, hey, I've got this great idea for a setting of a novel. It can be in this libertarian world where everyone's incorporated. Oh, that's great. So, you know, they sat down and wrote it together, but, you know, one of them is obviously dealing in one part and the other one's dealing in the other. Or it's just badly written. But I'd like to say it's just down to the two writers. That's about it, I think, with the writing. Except for one of the characters is called Gillette, and I'm thinking, well, Penn Gillette is a well-known libertarian. I'm thinking maybe characters in this book are named after well-known libertarians. Except I think Penn Gillette is the only well-known libertarian, I know. Was it Bob Barr? Maybe there's someone called Barr in there as well. I think he was a libertarian candidate or something like that, which is a bit strange, which actually makes me think back to Damon as well. And I was thinking there's some well-known sort of technology bloggers and personalities in that book as well. But again, I don't really know enough of them to be able to say, oh, yes, this person is definitely that person or is named for that person. But then again, they may be, may not be. Little thing I picked up on. Finally, really want to wrap this up quickly. The themes of the story, I've really talked about most of it, is mostly about self-ownership and freedom and liberty and, you know, economics and all that kind of stuff. And it's one of those, it's one of those kind of books which is the discussion of itself within itself. That's what the book is the discussion of its own themes. So for me to say, to now discuss the themes of this book, would be a bit, you know, sort of not really doing it justice, because that's what the book is. It's the book about, it's the theme of the book is the, and the message of the book is the message and the theme. But it is done very well. That's the, one of the strongest parts of the book, is that it literally does convince you that, hey, this personal incorporation stuff is pretty good. But then I'm thinking maybe one of, like the other brother was like, yeah, but it can't just be about that. It can't be pure propaganda. So we have to have Justin fighting against it. But you're like, but then Justin really does lose. You know, there is, like, I'm not talking about there's no reason for Justin not to incorporate. Oh, no, wait a second. Did I say that right? There's no reason. Yeah, there is no reason for Justin not to incorporate, except for the idea that he doesn't like slavery. But then it's explained to him that even in his day, when people didn't explicitly own parts of other people, or when they weren't explicitly incorporated, you know, personal incorporations, they were owned by their circumstances, and they were owned by this, and they were owned by their jobs, and, you know, they were held hostage by their families and their children and you know, their jobs and all this different kind of stuff. So he really didn't have a leg to stand on there at all, which is a bit strange. I would really like a better fight against the incorporation. If that's going to be your main thing, you really want more going on about it, you know. You know, it's like if someone says, ah, I'm going to write a book about peace, and I think everyone should be peaceful, and then you're like, yeah, but war is sometimes really necessary, and like, no it isn't, it's always peace. And they're like, look, Second World War, it was, you know, it could have been avoided, but really, you know, at the time we really had to fight against these Nazis. It's like, oh no, we're at peace. And, you know, it's in the end, of course, the Second World War, it was a fight worth fighting, you know. I mean, it's hard to make any argument against that. And I think because these guys are so sort of strong in their own ideas and this sort of personal incorporation idea, and it is a very good idea, and in the end, as long as everyone's in it voluntarily, yet everyone is in it, there's not a lot of problem. But as soon as you have one person unhappy, it sort of starts falling apart. And I think that they could have probably fought against their own idea, sort of tried to falsify their own idea a bit more. So, as a conclusion, lots of good stuff in this book. There's probably a fantastic 15-hour audiobook, you know, 300-page novel in here, except that, like I said, it's 400 and something. How many pages was it? Let me know. Yeah, 480 pages, and it should have been about 300, and it was 25-hour audiobook when it should have been about 15 or 16. Lots of great concepts, sort of quite passive execute. Well, I say passive, not passive in that other way, but I'm just saying sort of like you can just about get it. So I've mentioned a lot of the bad stuff, but the concept was strong, and I was happy to read or listen through to the end. Mainly, also, one of the main things is I really like the whole sort of, you know, fish out of water kind of meme idea trope, where someone goes to the future and wakes up in the future, you know, like the Demolition Man kind of thing. It's a good idea. And I like reading. It's like classic science fiction. And also the ideas that the world that is exploring is interesting. Really, the characters let it down, or the plot let it down, and really the writing let it down as well. But I'm going to give it 3 stars because it is... I did enjoy reading it, and there is a lot to think about. And I do think it's probably going to be one of those books that, you know, when you can't remember enough about the book and you've actually forgotten the plot, which means you forgot actually how bad the plot was, and you're just left with the ideas and the themes and the world, I'll probably enjoy this book in memory, in hindsight, more in the future. But if you do get a chance to read an abridged version, read an abridged version. Or, thinking, you know, it's one of those kinds of things, it's like, I reckon we could get, like, a way, I know it's completely illegal, but I reckon people could get a good market, just, like, unauthorized abridgments of novels this long, just get someone to say, just do an edit, take out one of the court scenes, cut out some of the subplots and stuff like that, and just do it, you know, actually, you know, have a proper editor work on it. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening. Next novel I'm going to read, actually I'm most of the way through, it's called Starfish by Peter Watts. I read one of his novels. It was the Vampire in Space novel. I can't remember what it's called though. Blindsight. And and I enjoyed it, so I'm going back and starting reading his first novel. He's very kind in giving away his novels for free. And I wish I could find one of his novels to buy, you know, because I'd just buy it because I did enjoy his first one, and I'm enjoying this one. So maybe I'll see about trying to find one of his novels to buy. I'm not quite sure how to go about it. Otherwise, yes, you can read along with me, Starfish by Peter Watts. You can download it for free from his website. Otherwise, thanks for listening. I've said that already. What do I normally say at this point? Oh, yeah, emails. Email me, luke@juggler.net. I do have some time blocked out tomorrow to actually reply to all of the emails that I've got so far. People are now actually sending me emails saying, hey, did you get this email that I sent you? It would be great to know that you actually got this book recommendation that I sent you. And I'm like sending emails back saying, yeah, sorry, I'm not getting back to the emails. But I will get back to them. luke@juggler.net. If you've got any book recommendations, go to goodreads.com/lukeverge to find out what I'm reading now. And also, if you become my friend, I can see what you're reading as well, which is always a lot of fun. And you can recommend books that way to me, which is also pretty cool. Follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge on Twitter, and you can find out all my updates, and I post when I'm releasing podcasts or what books I'm reading as well there. Also, just read my blog. Lots of photography, lots of video stuff, lots of juggling stuff, lots of writing stuff, lots of travel stuff, all going up there on my blog, which is at lukeburridge.com/blog, and enjoy that. There you go. I'm not going to say thanks for listening again, because I've said it 3 times now. That's it. Catch you next time.